Chapter 16. A very important line of research.
Laurent.
The lawyer waved us off when Sandrine and I asked him to place his cell phone and his laptop outside his office for our first closed-door meeting.
Look, we all know we're under surveillance, he said. I know they can hack me.
He wasn't specific about who exactly could do this hacking, but he had been specializing in press freedom and media issues for years, with many high-profile clients, including our partner, Le Monde. Of course, he had adversaries who would try to run cyber surveillance on him. That's why he was careful about what went into and came out of his mobile phone. So what was the big deal? The Pegasus Project partners had all agreed on a hard date for publication, less than 2 months away, and we really needed to put our legal team in place. Our lead attorney had to know everything, but we didn't feel comfortable talking about the most sensitive issues we were facing with electronics in the room. Sandrine and I insisted again. Cell phones and laptops outside the meeting. He did agree, but it was apparent he was just humoring us. This slightly blasé stance of his did not last long into our discussion. We explained to him that we were investigating NSO and its spyware system. We explained the capabilities of Pegasus, the zero-click exploits, for instance, and how an end user could activate the microphone and camera of a compromised phone by remote to capture live conversations. Veteran though he was plainly shocked by what he was hearing. He didn't ask a lot of questions while we walked him through what we had uncovered up to that day, May 21, 2021. The leaked list of 50,000 mobile phone numbers selected as potential targets by Pegasus end users around the world. Verified identities by the hundreds of those selected numbers, from journalists to human rights defenders, to opposition politicians, to private citizens who happened to be in contact with the targets. Many attorneys. We outlined the security lab's digital forensics and how Claudio and Danica had been able to isolate traces of attack or infection on most of the selected phones we had analyzed, somewhere north of 80% for iPhones. This, we felt, was a very strong indication that the list was solid. Jamal Khashoggi's widow was in the data, and we now had evidence of Pegasus attacks before his murder. Emmanuel Macron was on the list, along with more than a dozen officials in his administration, all selected by the NSO client in Morocco. The story was going to spread across Europe, Asia, the Middle East, and the Americas, with some serious geopolitical fallout, we told him. We expected that Forbidden Stories and its 16 reporting partners would draw serious fire, possibly even lawsuits. We needed his legal advice on our approaches to various victims, I explained, as well as our approach to NSO and the Pegasus system end users. We also wanted help in framing the stories, in vetting the language of the specific allegations we would be making, and in advising just how far we could go with the evidence we collected. Coordination with the legal departments from the various partners to make sure we had consistency would be critical. Above all, we needed his counsel on how best to ensure we kept our promise to protect the source. Like the best of attorneys, he was already thinking ahead. The immediate post-publication time was sure to be the most intense, he warned, and the potential for lawsuits was not likely to be the biggest problem we faced. Source protection worried him most. The appearance of President Macron and all those French government officials was a big red flag. The Macron administration would almost certainly make the claim that national security trumps the protection of a journalist source. The French secret services could make the argument that their agents abroad were in danger. They could even demand that we reveal the entire list, he said. French security officials might even show up at Forbidden Stores with a warrant to take possession of the computer drive that contained the data. The good news, we told him, was that we didn't have any such drive. Forbidden Stories and Amnesty International alone, and none of our other partners could access the original raw data. That was good, he agreed. The security services can try, he said, but let's make sure that in case the police come to search our offices, they won't find anything problematic. The countdown to publication was ticking for the first time since we had started the investigation. The Pegasus Project felt real now, but it also felt like something that could grow beyond our control. The partners were adding more reporters to the project and beginning to scramble them into the field all over the world. The chances of a mistake that unmasked the investigation increased by the day.
I could see it weigh on Sandrine. Among her many jobs on the project was to keep everybody within our strict security protocol.
There had been a disturbing breach even before our Paris meeting broke up. One of the newer partners had called an opposition politician in his country for a background interview about being a potential target of Pegasus spyware. The rule Sandrine had laid down for all the partners was that nobody approaches opposition politicians, who have notoriously loose lips, until the very end of the investigation. And then only when we had discussed it together and cleared it.
"What the fuck?" Sandrine said in private when she heard of the call.
She was a tad more diplomatic, but not much less forceful when she confronted the journalist who made the mistake. "Maybe you missed part of the explanation," she told him, "but it cannot happen again." The Pegasus project was shuttering up to full throttle, and the pressure was rising on all the partners. I felt especially sympathetic for the reporters and editors at Le Monde, who had been in the same national security soup as Forbidden Stories. They were investigating multiple stories about Morocco, many of which were sure to have serious geopolitical consequences. Le Monde reporters Martin Unthersinger and Damien Leloup, the two tech specialists at the newspaper, had been working with the list of phone numbers we had supplied them for more than 4 months, identifying selected targets and hunting patterns. New surprises hove up from the data every week. NSO's client Morocco had not only selected Macron and most of his key ministers, but also officials from other European and African countries, a former U.S. ambassador, and even members of King Mohammed VI's inner circle and his close family. Damien had just downed the king's father-in-law on the data. The breadth and reach of these selections, more than 5,000 in all, suggested manic activity in the Moroccan intelligence services, accompanied by an extreme lack of discipline. Martin and Damien were spending a lot of time trying to discern motive, which seemed to center on Morocco's concerns in its own near neighborhood. Macron's phone had been selected around the time he was traveling in Africa. His main advisor on African issues was selected by the Moroccan client at the same time. The decades-long battle over the independence of Western Sahara, which King Mohammed VI meant to rule, as a matter of Moroccan pride, seemed a strong candidate for motive. But Damien was having a hard time reckoning the path of the client's mania. "We've thought of several explanations," Damien told the partners. "None of them is extremely convincing." Help would have to wait. The risk of asking precise questions of the French government this far out from publication was too great. The Le Monde reporters even had to be careful in double and triple checking the identity of French officials on the list. The newspaper didn't yet have enough hard confirmation, for instance, to go to print with the fact that it was unquestionably Macron's mobile phone in the data. Approaching French government officials about doing forensics on their phones was a non-starter. "Obviously," Damien had explained to the group, "we have not gone to the Élysée Palace and asked for the phone of Macron." They did have reinforcements on this ungainly investigation into Morocco. A reporter from our new partner, Daraj, was reaching out to Hajar Raswani, the journalist who had fled Rabat for Sudan after being convicted and briefly imprisoned for having premarital sex with her fiancé. Hajar's mobile phone had now been verified, so we had a shot at forensics. Le Soir was doing its own reporting on Morocco because a recent Belgian prime minister was also in the data. A Radio France reporter was on the case too, and within a week of our big meeting in Paris, she had already contacted Joseph Brehm, a Paris-based attorney who represented jailed and exiled dissidents in Western Sahara, and convinced him to hand over his phone to Claudio and Danica. On May 21, 2021, the same day we were meeting with our lawyer, Brehm's phone turned up traces of a Pegasus infection. He pronounced himself willing to go on record. "There is no possible justification for a foreign state to listen to a French lawyer," Brehm said.
"There's no justification on a legal, ethical, or moral basis."
Things are progressing really quickly. Sandrine was able to report in the first project-wide update 4 days later on May 25. Holger Stark from Die Zeit was planning a trip to Israel to meet with a source, a former employee of NSO who was willing to speak off the record about the company. He also was trying to get an interview with somebody official at NSO. His colleague, Kai Berman, was on his way to Istanbul to meet with Turkish officials who might be able to shed some light on the Khashoggi killing and its aftermath. Dana Priest had also booked a trip to Istanbul, where she hoped to meet with Khashoggi's fiancé and facilitate the forensics on her phone. Szolbocs Pani was home in Budapest investigating the state of relations, warming, between Hungarian President Viktor Orban and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, right around the time NSO licensed Pegasus to Hungarian authorities. The Guardian's Stephanie Kirksgesner posted notes from her long off-the-record interview with a source who had deep knowledge of NSO. Stephanie's Guardian colleague, Michael Safi, was investigating India's possible targeting of people within the Dalai Lama's inner circle. First Macron, now the Dalai Lama, one of Sandrine's friends would joke with her. Who's next? Jesus? Christoph Klerks of Canuck had joined Zuduce Zaitung in its reporting on targets selected by Rwanda. Among the people he wanted to see was Karine Kanimba, who had been denouncing the Rwandan government in the lead-up to her father's upcoming trial on charges of terrorism, kidnapping, and murder. Karine's father, Paul Rusesabagina, was the Hotel Rwanda hero who saved more than 1,200 Hutus and Tutsis from murder during the genocide of 1994. His critical stance against the Rwandan ruling party in the intervening years had landed him in 2020 in a Kigali jail, where he had allegedly been tortured and now faced a certain conviction. The Rwandan president was loudly and publicly exclaiming Rusesabagina's guilt in the run-up to the trial. Miranda Petrusik of OCCRP had already verified a slew of the phone numbers in the data selected by Pegasus system operators in Azerbaijan, including 15 journalists, 28 civil rights activists and attorneys, and 50 leaders from the Azeri opposition party, even the deputy minister of defense. The best news from OCCRP was that Khadija Ismailova might be released from house arrest in Baku later that week. Miranda and a few of Khadija's other colleagues from OCCRP planned to meet Khadija in person in Ankara, Turkey, where it would finally be safe to inform her of the Pegasus infection on her cell phone. Claudio's confidence in the security lab's forensic findings kept growing, as did his desire to get this investigation over as soon as possible. Claudio and Danica were literally closing in on NSO. The earliest Pegasus Project forensics had been on phones infected back in 2018 and 2019, in the early days of zero-click exploits. But at least one mobile phone they analyzed in May had been infected within the previous 4 weeks. Recently infected iPhones offered new and slightly puzzling findings. It took some deciphering, comparing old backups to newer backups in the same iPhones, but Claudio and Danica became convinced that NSO was employing a new evasive maneuver. The company's coders and engineers, having realized their zero-click exploits were exposed to cyber researchers because the infections left discoverable traces of Pegasus in backup files, had added an extra layer of protection. Beginning in 2020, Pegasus exploits appeared to be much more assiduous in cleaning all evidence of attack and infection from a targeted phone and left behind fewer traces. What was more mysterious, though, and only becoming clear to Claudio and Danica in the last few weeks of May, was that NSO's Pegasus spyware was now trying to rewrite history. When a device was infected with the most recent version of Pegasus, the spyware was not only scrubbing forensic evidence of the new attack, but also attempting to erase the traces of Pegasus left behind by earlier attacks. This was a win-lose discovery for Claudio and Danica. On the upside, the security lab tool was still able to find old traces because the NSO cleaning agents were not all that meticulous. They scrubbed malicious process names from almost all of the columns in the data usage logs in the backup files, but not all of them. NSO operatives had been careless, Danica believed, because they had been arrogant. They seemed to think that they were too good to be caught. The downside to this discovery, though, was an unsettling confirmation of Claudio's and Danica's latest fear that NSO might be onto them. I mean, I don't know exactly what kind of visibility NSO might have into our forensics, Claudio told Sandrine and me. But it would be foolish of them not to have some kind of visibility over a phone they already owned. They could probably see if somebody's doing something. Paloma understood that speed mattered more than ever when she headed back to Mexico near the end of May.
We had been working the story of Pegasus in Mexico longer than any other, going back to the cartel project at the end of 2020.
Paloma and the rest of the team had developed a profusion of leads, which had so far turned out to be somewhere between tantalizing and maddeningly difficult to tie down. We were counting on Paloma and our increasingly close partnership with Carmen Arestegui, one of the most admired and popular journalists in Mexico. Carmen had contacted us with congratulations after the cartel project, and we took the opportunity to ask her if she would be willing to join our investigation into NSO. She seemed interested. Carmen had a long and tortured history with the company, its resellers in Mexico, and the government watchdogs who were supposed to protect privacy rights and freedom of the press. The media company she had founded, Arestegui Noticias, had been the first to reveal the spread of cyber surveillance in Mexico back in the summer of 2012, and she and her team published the operational and financial details of contracts between the Mexican army and NSO's reseller in the country at the time, Susumo Azano. 5 separate contracts worth between $350 and $400 million, Arestegui Noticias reported, were processed without bidding and approved by direct assignment to the company's security tracking devices, SADCV. The story had little impact in the moment. The Mexican army ran a pair of cursory audits into the secret contracts and closed the case within months with no explanation beyond lack of elements.
Carmen's initial report on cyber surveillance, along with her critical reporting on President Enrique Peña Nieto's questionable real estate deals, had drawn heightened scrutiny from Mexican authorities.
Carmen herself was one of the first known victims of Pegasus, along with her 16-year-old son. Their targeting was confirmed by Citizen Lab in 2017.
The criminal complaint she had filed against the Mexican government, however, was still being slow-walked by prosecutors.
Carmen had been reporting on the subject of cyber surveillance in Mexico longer than any journalist in the world and knew more about it than almost anyone. But she was intrigued by what little we could tell her over an unsecure phone line and clearly wanted to hear more. Paloma flew down to Mexico City at the end of March 2021 to explain to Carmen what we had.
We couldn't show Carmen or tell her about all the data we had access to back in March, but we decided the best thing to do was to run the match a name game from her contacts file to our leaked list of the 15,000 possible targets selected by NSO's Mexican clients.
About 10 minutes into the exercise, Carmen was astounded. There turned out to be more than 60 matches among her contacts. Scores of journalists, parents of the students detained by local police and killed by the drug lords in Ayotzinapa. The government official who was supposed to be overseeing the dormant investigation into the deaths. More than a dozen powerful political figures. Even a Catholic priest who had won human rights prizes for his work with immigrants. Politicians and journalists and a priest, Carmen joked. Who can be our salvation? At certain points in the discussion, Carmen would look at a name and exclaim, "Oh, geez. Oh, no. Not her." And brutal. One surprise was the nefarious and very energetic game of political espionage someone in the Peña Nieto administration seems to have been playing. The most intimate friends and advisors to opposition candidate Andre Manuel López Obrador, known as AMLO, who had won the presidency in 2018, were in the data. "He is one of the most trusted men of the current president," Carmen told Paloma, pointing at one match from our data. "They already have his driver, his cardiologist, the director of his baseball club," Paloma replied. "Let's see," Carmen said, looking at her own list of matches. "There's his driver and his cardiologist. Then his wife, his 3 kids." "His kids? How many children on your list?" "He has 4 children," Paloma answered. "And there are 3 who are on the list." "Not the little one. Only the older 3? "Yes." Some of the matches ended up being inside Carmen's own circle of intimates, most of the people selected at the very time she was first targeted. Her personal assistant, one of her longtime producers, even her sister. When Carmen checked in with her sister the next day, Teresa Arestegui pointed to an SMS message she received at the time, which looked to be from a friend. "My father has passed away. We are dismayed. I'm sending you the address to accompany us." Teresa Arestegui was supposed to click on a link. These tracked with the type of SMS messages and links Carmen was also getting back in 2016.
It's been 5 days since my daughter shows up. I will be grateful if you share this photo. We are desperate. And, dear Carmen, my brother died in an accident. I'm devastated. I'm sending info for the wake. I hope you will attend. And worse, one her 16-year-old son had received. Beheaded journalist found in Veracruz after threatening narcos. Details and photos. This technology was in the hands of a bunch of operators who were behaving like thugs and who couldn't resist taunts even as they were trying to infect people, one horrified cyber researcher had noted. At one point in the name-matching session with Paloma, it was clear Carmen wanted in on this investigation. She mentioned something very enticing. A cache of more than 20,000 documents she had received from a source who worked for NSO's suspected sales agent in Mexico, Yuri Ansbacher. But Carmen wanted to think about how to use this treasure. She was not yet ready to share all of it with the group. The biggest moment in the entire session turned out to be pretty early, match number 12. This phone belongs to Xavier Olea, Carmen pointed out, obviously intrigued. He is a criminal lawyer who is the state attorney of Guerrero. He is also the prosecutor who was in charge of the investigation into the death of Cecilio Pineda. Cecilio was a journalist Paloma knew all about. His unexplained murder in one of the most dangerous areas of Mexico. A spot near enough to the mountains to provide good cover for drug manufacturing and near enough to the Pacific Ocean to make for easy export to the hungry U.S. market was a story Forbidden Stories had been tracking from its first days in operation. Prosecutor Olea, who insisted on around-the-clock protection for his wife and children and traveled in an armored car, would later tell us that he was informed of threats against Cecilio, and that it was pretty obvious he had been killed because of his reporting on the drug cartels, especially on their practice of kidnapping locals and ransoming them for cash. Olea called Cecilio bold, but the way he said it, it didn't sound like a compliment. You know that Cecilio Pineda is also in the data, Paloma told Carmen. He might have been spied on? Carmen asked. Well, it makes sense. This will be a very important line of research. Cecilio Pineda. Paloma didn't need to be told this. She had been trying to verify Cecilio's number from day one of the Pegasus project. She had succeeded only about 10 days before her meeting with Carmen at the end of March 2021, and then managed to get a secret phone call with Cecilio's nervous widow, Marisol. I don't want problems, were the first words out of her mouth. Marisol said she had told her husband to stop his investigations of the drug cartels, but he was stubborn. So was Marisol. I don't want to know who killed him, she had told Paloma in that first call. He's dead and won't come back. Marisol did provide a second source to verify that the mobile phone number we had for Cecilia was accurate, which proved he had been selected for targeting just a month before his murder in March 2017. But forensics weren't yet possible because Marisol didn't have the phone. The police had returned the clothes and shoes Cecilio had been wearing the day of his murder, nothing else. She told Paloma to check with Cecilio's friend Israel Flores, a fellow journalist who had rushed to the scene of the shooting. Paloma had reached Israel Flores in early May, and their conversation only deepened the mystery of the phone. Israel said he had seen the device lying on the ground next to his wounded friend when he arrived at the crime scene, but he hadn't thought to pick it up. He left the scene to go with Cecilio to the hospital and was with him when he died in the ambulance. The federal police called Israel in soon after to interview him about Cecilio's death. Israel told Paloma that they had one chief interest. They really wanted to know about that phone. The questions were all about who was nearest to the phone, Israel told Paloma. Where were the EMTs? Who had the phone? Paloma's final trip to Mexico near the end of May 2021 was sort of a roller coaster. Further efforts with Marisol, Israel, and the criminal investigators had been to no avail. The phone was still missing. But Paloma had a backup from the Guardian's Nina Lacani, who was back in Mexico after working on the cartel project there the previous year. Proceso and Aristegui Noticias had each put one of their best-informed and most capable investigative reporters on the project. Best of all, Carmen had decided to share her 20,000 leaked documents with all the reporters on the Pegasus project. This document dump was set to happen at the very same time we reeled in the final, crucial partner in our investigation, the Israel-based newspaper, Haaretz. Amitai Ziv, A telecom and tech reporter from Haaretz's financial supplement, had been a very capable contributor to the cartel project. Pegasus had been a tiny part of the cartel project, and only because of our last-minute confirmation of the targeting of Jorge Carrasco's mobile phone. Amitai had helped the investigation with key contacts at NSO and competitor companies, and around the Israeli tech industry in general. We knew Amitai could provide all those things and more on the Pegasus project. But Sandrine and I had been shy to invite him into the Pegasus project. Israel's national security policies are a big obstacle for journalists in the country. Military censors had wide latitude to kill off news items, and there was a legal requirement that they be permitted to read anything that touched on national security before publication. Claudio, meanwhile, had been even more adamant about keeping Haaretz at arm's length. He kept warning us that the risk of interception was just too great because Israel was just too small. Cyber surveillance, he explained, is much easier when a target is right around the corner. At the same time, almost all the partners recognized the need for reporters on the ground in Israel. Coming out of our second meeting in Paris, Sandrine and I were hearing that request more and more often. We pressed Claudio again, and he relented. We contacted Amitai about a week after the second meeting, and he flew to Paris a week later. Amitai appeared quite surprised by the scale of the data leak, the results of the forensics, and the reporting the partners had already done. But when we asked him about the impact the Pegasus project would have on NSO and the Israeli government, he looked at us with a bit of a side eye. "Well, nothing," he said matter-of-factly. "NSO has stories coming at them all the time. It doesn't make a difference." He did offer a more optimistic outlook on another front. Our worries about the military censors were overblown, he insisted, because NSO was a private company. He wouldn't have to share much with the MOD. Timing matters, and it really mattered in this case. Amitai and Haaretz officially came aboard the Pegasus project on May 26, 2021, which was also the day Carmen delivered a tranche of 20,000 documents that connected multiple Mexican government agencies, NSO, and NSO's go-to reseller in Mexico, the elusive Yuri Ansbacher. The original leak, Carmen explained, came in the form of two encrypted USB sticks delivered by a whistleblower inside Ansbacher's complicated web of companies. The Israeli businessman worked hard to keep his finances and his business activity veiled from public view. The leaker, who signed all his emails to Carmen, Hunter of Hunters, ripped off that veil. The 20,000 digital copies of documents he had handed over to Carmen in 2019 included contracts, pages of bank statements, and proof of payments, including enormous payments to Shalev Holy. The whistleblower had also told Carmen that one of Ansbacher's lieutenants, who received training on Pegasus at NSO offices in Israel, had operated the system on select targets at the request of the sitting government. They knew absolutely everything about AMLO's life, the source explained. Carmen had seen this lieutenant's mobile phone number in the data back in March. Pegasus operators often ended up in the data because they used their own phones to provide demonstrations for potential customers. Carmen had not been ready to share much of this leaked data with us back in March, before she was officially part of the Pegasus project, or even in the first weeks after joining. But now, at the end of May, she was all in. Carmen understood that Mexico was part of a much bigger global story, but she also understood that her home country was Exhibit A of what happens when spyware like Pegasus flies wild for years without necessary safeguards in place. Her whistleblower was crucial to showing that. We might just be able to prove that a private company in Mexico was using Pegasus to perform unwarranted surveillance on people who were neither criminal nor criminal suspects. Here is where I felt the project getting a new kind of traction. I already knew from our previous work together that Amitai could add real texture to Carmen's extraordinary paper trail. At the end of May 2021, our new partner in Israel told us he was confident he could get an interview with Yuri Ansbacher.